And I don't think we've had an honest conversation about guns and gun policy in the United States for more than 50 years since President Johnson raised the issue of gun registration. Biden has put us an assault weapons ban and the issue of registering existing assault weapons for those who want to keep them as part of his plan. But he hasn't discussed the details. He hasn't explained to the American people how this would work, how this would not be a threat to people's freedom or lead to tyranny or genocide. And the problem is the Democrats have been trying to see what they can get past as opposed to taking a long-term strategic approach to challenging the propaganda that's been put out by the NRA for 40 years. Because the difference between the United States and New Zealand and Australia is the fact that we have the NRA, and even as the NRA is going down, it's their ideology that remains. And that's what hasn't been challenged. And the entire leadership of the GOP has bought into this ideology. So that has to be challenged. I don't think an assault weapons ban is going to happen under this administration, not unless the Democrats do extremely well in the midterms. Yes, removing the filibuster would eliminate a barrier, but the Republicans could come up with other ways to impede legislation. And the problem is the Democrats have finally gotten to the point where they've put real gun reform on the table, but we're still years away from getting there.
Frank Smyth, we want to thank you so much for being with us, longtime investigative journalist, author of The NRA, The Unauthorized History. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for senior news producer.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Spring is here. Flowers are blooming. New buds are on the trees. And that means it's time for the KBOO Grateful Dead and Friends Spring Marathon. The Grateful Dead and Friends hosts have been scouring their vaults to share 7 hours of choice and rare recordings with you. Tune in and turn it up on Saturday, April 3rd, from noon to 7 p.m., as your Grateful Dead and Friends hosts bring you great music, fun insights, and a gentle reminder to support your community-powered radio station, KBOO Portland.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and/or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, prison guards in Oregon are refusing to get vaccinated, putting prisoners and other staff in danger of contracting the virus. Amazon is now requiring workers to consent to even more surveillance or lose their job, and the 7th mass shooting in as many days is bringing gun legislation to the forefront once again. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 316 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 162,016. Oregon health officials also reported 2 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 2,367 people. There are currently 109 people hospitalized statewide from COVID, including 16 patients in intensive care units. The majority of Oregon counties will be in either the moderate or lower risk categories when the state's new COVID-19 risk levels begin this Friday, March 26th. The counties in the Portland metro area will remain at moderate risk level until at least April 8th. To preempt a spike in COVID-19 cases due to spring break, Oregon State University will be offering COVID testing for all students at the Corvallis and Bend campuses. As of today, 1 million Oregonians have been vaccinated, says the Oregon Health Authority. That's around 3 in 10 Oregonians that have now received at least one dose of a vaccine. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 30 million cases of COVID-19. At least 543,000 people have died across the country. So far, about 25% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, with 14% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 124 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.7 million people have died. More than 3,000 of Oregon's prisoners and at least 800 prison staffers have tested positive for the coronavirus, with 42 prisoners having died from the virus. One reason why the outbreak has been so large in prisons is that some prison guards don't believe the pandemic is real. In a civil trial in Malheur County, staff from the Snake River Correctional Institute in Ontario, Oregon, described a culture among prison guards who ignore mask mandates, believe COVID-19 is no worse than the flu, and refer to the disease as a, quote, plandemic. Dr. Garth Gulick, chief medical officer at Snake River, said during the trial, quote, I also live in a part of the country where the staff is incredibly ingrained that masking is stupid, this virus doesn't hurt. 71% of staff at the Snake River Prison, Malheur County's largest employer, live in Idaho, where COVID skepticism is widespread. Several other suits have been filed by prisoners at other Oregon prisons related to the COVID pandemic and the vaccine. Two prisoners of the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville revealed to a lawyer that staff had told them the vaccine could cause infertility. To date, at least 70% of Department of Corrections prisoners have accepted first doses of the vaccine, while vaccination rates of staff are unclear as the department stopped tracking that information earlier this year. Andrea Valderrama was appointed by the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners to represent East Portland's District 47 in the state legislature. Valderrama has worked in Oregon politics for years and now serves as chair of the David Douglas School Board as well as policy director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. She previously served as a policy advisor for former Portland Commissioner Stephen Novick as well as Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler. Valderrama fills the vacancy left when Representative Diego Hernandez resigned on March 15th. Hernandez resigned after an internal investigation found he had created a hostile workplace environment for women at the Capitol. Valderrama was one of several women who had raised the alarm about Hernandez's behavior, accusing him of domestic violence when they were in a relationship. She told the county board yesterday, quote, We need decision makers who don't just listen to directly impacted communities. They are themselves directly impacted. Amazon delivery drivers across the country must sign a consent form enabling the company's artificial intelligence-equipped cameras to monitor their every move and collect their biometric data, or they will lose their jobs at the end of this week. Roughly 75,000 drivers work for Amazon in the U.S. alone, although they aren't officially employed by Amazon, but by around 800 subcontractors known as delivery service partners. Just last month, Amazon began installing AI-powered four-lens cameras in its delivery vans. According to labor journalist Lauren Gurley, the cameras, quote, are able to sense when a driver yawns, appears distracted, or isn't wearing a seatbelt, and monitor drivers' body and facial movements. Earlier this month, Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Ed Markey, Richard Blumenthal, and Cory Booker sent a letter raising concerns about the policy to Amazon's chief executive, Jeff Bezos. The senators wrote, quote, While we applaud efforts to improve safety on the roads and decrease the plague of distracted driving, this surveillance could in practice create significant pressure on drivers to speed up their routes, which can lead to driver fatigue and decrease safety. Amazon's policies have been deemed problematic by workers' rights advocacy groups in the past, citing unreasonable working conditions that included monitoring their every move and comparing the environment to sweatshops. Around 6,000 workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, began voting last month to unionize. This would be the first Amazon workplace to form a union. Amazon reported that at least 20,000 of its workers contracted coronavirus in 2020, All the while, Amazon cut the $2 per hour hazard pay raise while the pandemic continued to rage across the U.S. Meanwhile, Bezos' income exploded due to the pandemic, increasing his wealth by $7 million an hour. Oxfam put out a report in September of 2020 stating that even if Bezos had given every employee a bonus of $100,000, Bezos would still have been wealthier at the end of the pandemic than he was at the start. 10 people were killed on Monday when a shooter opened fire at a grocery store in Boulder, Colorado. The shooter was apprehended and is facing 10 counts of murder in the first degree. Jen Psaki is a spokesperson for the Biden administration. Psaki said on Wednesday that the president would like to address gun access, community violence, and other root causes. President Biden also intends to focus on making background checks mandatory for ghost guns, guns that don't have a serial number and whose sales are thus much more difficult to track. Many of these weapons are homemade with 3D printers, making them harder to regulate. Another potential action includes strengthening the federal background check system so that it'll alert law enforcement when someone's background check fails. President Biden also campaigned on the pledge to send $900 million to community programs meant to combat violence. The shooting comes just 1 week after another mass shooting in Atlanta, which targeted women of Asian descent working at spas in the area and resulted in the murder of 8. These mass shootings are among at least 7 such mass incidents in the last 7 days, including 3 incidents on Saturday alone in Houston, Dallas, and Philadelphia. Jury selection has concluded in the murder trial against Derek Chauvin, as a 15th and final juror was selected Tuesday. The final juror, a white man in his 20s, says he respects police but questions the behavior of officers charged with the murder of George Floyd. Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes until he died last May. For more, we go to the Racial Reckoning Project.
Jury selection has concluded in the Derek Chauvin trial. On Tuesday, the court selected a 15th and final juror, a white male accountant in his 20s. The juror expressed strong support for police, yet he questioned the behavior of the officers charged with George Floyd's murder. Defense attorney Eric Nelson read from the juror's questionnaire.
You wrote, "While I do not have all the facts of the case, it seems like it would not have taken 4 officers to respond to a call regarding a counterfeit bill, and that the restraint of George Floyd for 5 to 10 minutes may have been unnecessary."
Racial Reckoning reporter Georgia Fort was in the courtroom Tuesday. She says entering the courthouse was like going through airport security, a pleasant but sometimes tense, heavily guarded process that one juror described as intimidating. Fort says the security can make some jurors feel safe. For Black and brown people with negative experiences with law enforcement, it could have the opposite effect. At times, she found being the only Black person in the room challenging. One juror was excused after making several comments that were dismissive of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter.
That was a tense moment for me as a Black person, profession aside. I just had to have a moment where I stopped taking notes and I looked around and everybody just kept doing what they were doing. Like, it didn't impact them, but that was hard for me to hear that's someone's true understanding of what happened.
Now that jury selection is over, the trial is on recess until Monday, March 29, when the prosecution and the defense will make opening statements. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Fevan Garazgihar.
The Senate has started hearings on a massive voting rights bill that could affect future elections. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Our hearts go out for the survivors, who had to flee for their lives and who hid, terrified.
President Joe Biden offered condolences to the families of the 10 victims of Monday's mass shooting in Colorado, including police officer Eric Talley. Authorities say the 21-year-old suspect purchased the assault rifle used in the shooting just 6 days earlier. Biden urged Congress to close background check loopholes and ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines.
This is not, it should not be a partisan issue. This is an American issue. It will save lives.
During a Senate committee hearing on Tuesday, Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin called gun violence a public health crisis. Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley said he supports reform, but questioned new bills passed by the House.
Like many Americans, I cherish my right to bear arms. in the dialogue about gun control. We rarely consider how many Americans are united in their advocacy and enjoyment of this right.
Professional shooter Chris Chang noted the recent spike in anti-Asian violence and said minority communities need the ability to defend themselves.
At the root of our country's violence is not firearms. The root causes of human violence and hate are many: low self-esteem, lack of mental health resources, community, education, job opportunities, and a lack of humanity.
The hearing was scheduled last week after the deadly shootings in Atlanta. Senators Mazie Hirono of Hawaii and Tammy Duckworth of Illinois are condemning the lack of Asian American and Pacific Islanders represented in the Biden administration, saying they will oppose nominees until there is a commitment towards more diversity. A Senate hearing starts today on the For the People Act, which aims to combat voter suppression and end the influence of money on politics.
Voting rights are under assault in America like they haven't been since the Jim Crow era.
Wendy Weiser with the Brennan Center for Justice says more than 250 bills to restrict access to voting are pending in 43 states.
We need to restore a baseline set of values of we all can participate and the playing field is fair and the rules cannot be manipulated.
Republicans argue the measure is a power grab by Democrats. While marking the 11th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act on Wednesday, President Biden announced a three-month extension of a special enrollment period for the federal insurance marketplace. Americans now have until August 15th to enroll. And the White House economic team is drafting a $3 trillion package to boost the economy, reduce carbon emissions, and narrow economic inequality. It includes an infrastructure plan that could be funded in part through tax increases on corporations and the wealthy. At the southern border, the Pentagon is being asked to temporarily house unaccompanied migrant children at two Texas military installations. There's increasing pressure to end the media blackout at those facilities. The Biden administration cites COVID-19 and privacy concerns for blocking access. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Clean Energy for All effort in the Oregon legislature. Then at 5:45, we'll hear news from the BOO, your look at the news inside KBOO with our very own Jenna Yokoyama. At 6, it's the Underground. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow we can expect scattered showers with a high of 54. Today in history, in 1912, civil rights activist and leader Dorothy Hite was born. She focused on illiteracy, unemployment, and voter rights, as well as the deep inequality of women and African Americans. The quote of the day is from Hite, who said, quote, "I want to be remembered as someone who used herself and anything she could touch to work for justice and freedom. I want to be remembered as one who tried." Three tribes in Alaska are participating in a pilot program to collect data as well as provide solutions on a community level to address missing and murdered Indigenous people. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Three tribes in Alaska are participating in a pilot program to collect data and provide solutions on a community level to address missing and murdered Indigenous people. KDLG's Brian Venwa spoke with officials about how the new project will change their approach on active and cold cases.
At the beginning of the year, the U.S. Attorney's Office for Alaska announced that the Department of Justice would embark on a pilot project to address the missing and murdered Indigenous persons epidemic in the state. The Chugiang Tribal Council in Dillingham is one of three Alaska tribes that volunteered to be part of the project. Each tribe will develop a tribal community response plan tailored to its needs, resources, and culture. According to a study by the Urban Indian Health Institute, out of 29 states, Alaska ranks fourth in the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Tribal Administrator Courtney Carty says the importance of gathering statistics on a local level.
A all too often Native communities are researched by outsiders in this situation. It's very important that, especially with such a sensitive topic, that our council is able to work with families directly to quantify the issue and demonstrate that ourselves versus having an outside organization do that for us.
The tribe meets with the U.S. Attorney's Office as part of a forum to increase communication between communities and public officials. Ingrid Cumberledge is the MMIP coordinator for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alaska. She says that a key to reduce MMIP cases is to establish connections between tribes and agencies and to implement solid tribal community response plans.
We really just need to build those relationships and make sure that everybody is reporting as soon as possible so that we can get working on any incident at the quickest possible moment.
Brian Schroeder, the U.S. Attorney for Alaska, stressed that it is important to establish communication and transparency before crises occur.
A large part of what this is getting all the parties involved, all the stakeholders involved, to start talking to each other now. You want to be able to talk ahead of time and know each other and open those lines of communication.
Chugyung's plan will serve as a model for hub communities like Bethel and Nome. More information about the pilot project can be found by contacting the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Brian Venwa.
In Montana, after launching a fund to assist families of missing persons in gathering evidence, Snowbird Fund committee members say public interest in the project has allowed them to increase the fund. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports.
Ivan McDonald is a filmmaker who's been documenting the missing and murdered Indigenous women's crisis for years and serves on the Snowbird Fund committee. At Montana's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Task Force meeting, he said the fund acts as a bridge, connecting families to money they need to respond quickly.
We know that so often in those missing persons cases or when someone turns up missing, those first few hours are so incredibly important, and research shows that the number one reason that the Department of Justice declines these cases in Indian country is due to lack of evidence and sort of all of those things, forensic evidence.
With grants starting at $500, the Snowbird Fund helps families cover search costs, such as gas for vehicles, drones to survey an area, or food to feed search parties. Grant applicants must be affiliated with an active missing persons case. I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
The Assembly Judiciary Committee in the California Legislature approved a measure Tuesday to allow state and local court employees to receive paid holiday on California Native American Day. The bill by Assemblymember James Ramos would amend a code to recognize Native American Day as a judicial holiday. Paid judicial holidays are designated in a different code from holidays recognized by other state agencies. The bill would not create an additional paid holiday, but would exchange Columbus Day for California Native American Day. It advanced by a 10-0 vote. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Today is Equal Pay Day, meant to represent the outrageous pay gap that still exists between women and men. Women are paid on average about 82 cents for every dollar men make. The gap is even larger in some states like Washington, where women only make 78 cents for every dollar men make. And the reality is even more stark for women of color. Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service has the story.
Today is Equal Pay Day, which represents how long into 2021 a woman would have to work in order to earn what a man did on average in 2020. The marker highlights the pay gap that persists for women. But Gabrielle Quintana with the Seattle-based Economic Opportunity Institute says women of color achieve equal pay with white men even later in the year.
We mask it by clumping us all together, but the reality of it is that women of color are still way behind white women.
Black Women's Equal Pay Day is August 3rd. For Native American women, it's September 8th. And for Latina women, it's October 21st this year. Women are paid about 82 cents on average for every dollar men make. But the gap is even larger in Washington state, where women make about 78 cents for every dollar men make. Quintana says state lawmakers have tried to close the pay gap with blanket policies for all women, such as preventing employers from asking prospective employees about their salary history. But she believes there are better approaches.
So I think that we need to look at targeted policies that really are goal-oriented, which means starting to look at data and really seeing where the big gaps are, where the big problems are.
She says other policies like overtime pay, paid family and medical leave, and paid sick leave also are important for addressing the pay gap. The pandemic has been especially hard on women, as they often are primary caregivers for children, and with schools closed, they've had to juggle kids and jobs. but women also are falling out of the job market faster than men. A December report found 154,000 job losses, and all of them were women of color. Quintana isn't surprised.
COVID has really exposed that, in that it has been women, and it has been brown women, who have been impacted the most during COVID.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Scientists are working to make solar panels more efficient, and a new material has set a new efficiency record for its class. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Installing more solar panels is one way to put more of the sun's energy on the grid. Another is to increase the amount of power each panel can generate. The challenge for scientists is to develop solar cells that convert more of the sun's rays to electricity without making the technology too expensive.
We need to take into account that when we want to improve the solar cell or increase the efficiency, that the costs are not exploding.
Last year, Ike Kunin and other researchers at the Helmholtz Center for Materials and Energy in Berlin developed a prototype that set a new efficiency record for its class. It stacks two cells on top of each other. One is made from silicon, which is commonly used in solar cells and is good at capturing infrared light. The second is made of a low-cost material called perovskite, which captures visible light.
And as these two parts can be converted more efficiently into electrical energy than by just one absorbing material, we can get higher efficiencies with these solar cells.
That means they can generate more electricity from the same amount of sunshine and help get more clean energy on the grid. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has both hands up.
10 killed in a Boulder supermarket, 8 killed in 3 Atlanta spas. We haven't had any school shootings because schools were closed. But it's my right as an American to kill as many as quickly as I can. The United States was built on superior weaponry and the ability to see other peoples as not people. In America, the wealthy and corporate buy new laws and keep outmoded laws from being changed. No country sells more weapons than the U.S. No country spends more on weapons than the U.S. It would be more honest if the Department of Defense was still called the War Department or maybe the Department of Death. Portland has had a record amount of gun violence, so Mayor Wheeler wants more money for the militarily armed police, whose union president resigned after smearing City Councilor Hardesty, who advocates defunding the police. I put a box from shotgun shells I found out in my curbside recycling to warn passersby that I'm an American too. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
A Republican in Idaho is calling for the removal of 4 dams along the Lower Snake River. He wants nuclear energy to be part of the mix to replace its hydropower in the region, but environmental advocacy groups say nuclear plants produce radioactive waste and don't lead to a carbon-free future. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Nuclear energy could be part of the mix to replace power from 4 Lower Snake River dams if they're removed. Idaho Congressman Mike Simpson's plan calls for removing the 4 dams to aid the ailing salmon populations of the Northwest. Small modular reactors to produce nuclear energy could play a role in replacing their hydropower. Ian Cotton with the Snake River Alliance says the proposal also touches on increasing renewable energy, transmission capacity, and energy efficiency.
Those are all things that really excite us, at the prospect of those becoming a bigger piece of our Northwest's energy infrastructure. But as far as the role of small modular reactors goes with this plan, it really feels like to us it's a piece that doesn't quite fit with the rest of the puzzle.
The $33 billion plan includes $10 billion for energy replacement once the dams are removed. Some environmental groups say nuclear power needs to be part of the energy makeup in order to decarbonize the economy in the coming decades. Don Safer, co-chair of the Sierra Club Nuclear Free Campaign, says energy isn't the only product of the industry. It also produces radioactive waste.
There's just this debit to the future that we're creating this material that we don't really know how to dispose of, and the problems will become more and more pronounced as we go forward.
Simpson's Northwest Infrastructure Plan would modernize the region's energy sector, bringing more renewables online. Safer says the small modular reactor design proposed for nuclear projects is still unproven technology, meaning the return on investment may not be as much as people assume.
The small modular reactors are just not a good choice, especially in the West, where you have plenty of solar, you have plenty of wind, and the money would be better spent developing better cost-effective storage technology, which is coming.
Simpson's plan could be included in a massive infrastructure package the Biden administration is putting together. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Althea Billings. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Three bills in the Oregon legislature aim to pave a path for a clean energy future for the state. They're supported by the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign and address a variety of interconnected issues, from the need for more affordable utility bills to preparing for 100% clean energy with an eye toward environmental and racial justice. I spoke with Nikita Daryanani, the Climate and Energy Policy Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color, to learn more about the effort.
So the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign broadly is working on three bills in the state legislature that pertain to clean energy this session. So I want to talk through them because they each address a different facet of that issue. So to start, let's talk about House Bill 2021, Clean Energy for All. What does that bill do?
Yeah, so you're right. HB 2021 is a suite, is part of a suite of bills driven by the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign. So it sets a 100% clean energy standard for the state of Oregon. So it requires that by 2040, Oregon's utility customers will be powered 100% by non-emitting resources. So this just means energy resources that don't emit greenhouse gases. And it was really born out of a vision for a clean energy future that is grounded in environmental justice, focusing on maximizing benefits to low-income communities of color and reducing harm to these communities as well. And I think what's important here is that the transition to clean energy will happen. So it's a chance for us to make sure that those who are the most impacted by our current energy system can share in the benefits of its transition. So these are benefits like reduction in pollution, but also job creation and resilience through local clean energy projects. So it's a great step forward to decarbonizing Oregon, reducing emissions from energy generation, and is also a chance to ensure economic development and jobs are happening locally.
I'm interested in the part where you said that the transition to clean energy is going to happen, but this is an opportunity to be intentional about how we want it to look in Oregon.
Yeah, right. So I think to start off with, I think we can talk about the federal government's efforts. So I think it's fair to say we'll see clean energy and infrastructure investments from the federal government. I know that the Biden administration is focusing on climate change and has made the claim to set a nationwide 100% clean energy standard, but I don't think we know when that will be or when that fight will take place. I think that's why it's great that Oregon is looking to take action as a state so that when the transition to clean energy is moving forward, that we can ensure that the people who are at the front lines of climate change and the poorest people in our state and the most impacted can benefit from it. So we're really setting the groundwork for an equitable energy system. And so this is an opportunity to do that in a way that that benefits and lifts up the people who are traditionally left behind by environmental policy. And energy.
So then there's the second of the three bills, House Bill 2475, Energy Affordability. Now there's been a renewed focus on the burden of energy bills since the pandemic hit and people's, you know, economic situations have shifted massively. How does that bill tie the, like, the issue of the burden of energy bills to the idea of clean energy?
Yeah, so HB 2475, or the Oregon Energy Affordability Act, basically allows the Public Utilities Commission, or the PUC, which is a state, an Oregon state agency that is the governing body that regulates the biggest utilities in Oregon, and allows those utilities to create a low-income rate class and consider environmental justice factors and energy burden when they are setting rates for different customers for energy for their utilities. So energy burden is typically defined as the percentage of your household income that's spent on energy costs. So this bill is really working to reduce energy burden for those who are the most burdened by energy bills. Everyone should be able to pay their utility bills. So I think what's important about this bill is that it provides, it allows us to take into consideration the other factors that homes and families are going through and the other costs that they might have. So, you know, rent and food and transportation. And it kind of takes the load off of those expenses because people need electricity and energy in their homes to survive and to live and to thrive and feed their families. So this bill helps to make that happen by, you know, allowing the regulatory agency a tool to make rates specific for low income folks. And I think the way that this ties into clean energy is that renewable energy now is cheap. It's cheap, and so it can help reduce people's energy bills. And so it's important. I think it works really well together with all of the other two bills in our campaign, in that we're addressing sort of the main pieces of an inequitable energy system. So we're hitting energy affordability in a way that builds equity in our energy system.
And then for the third one, it's House Bill 2842, which pertains to healthy homes. And that bill would support home improvements in low-income households across Oregon. Why is that a critical goal for the state at this moment?
Yeah, I think this moment really has illuminated how important it is for folks to be healthy and how important public health is. And a lot of the homes in Oregon are pretty old. I think 54% of Oregonians live in housing that's built before 1978. And I think when the pandemic hit, I think it's really important that we are focusing on not just the public health risks that folks might have when they leave their homes, but also the public health and health hazards that folks might be experiencing inside their homes, especially important during a pandemic that has required many of us to stay inside our homes. So House Bill 2842, the Healthy Homes Bill, will create a fund or a program within the Oregon Health Authority. So this is another state agency within Oregon, basically distributing grants to local housing authorities or nonprofits or local governments to help fund some of the really important upgrades and repairs that can cause major hazards to folks living in their homes. So this can include radon or lead abatement in homes, or fire hardening, or other upgrades that folks might have, removal of allergy triggers or asthma triggers. Additionally, I think what's really important, especially given the recent wildfires in Oregon, is this bill could also help fund installations of air purification systems in homes, so that when there are wildfires, folks are safe from wildfire smoke in their homes, and that's not a trigger to their chronic illnesses or impacting their lungs. So I think now, especially given the climate disasters that Oregon has faced, in addition to the public health crisis and economic crisis that the pandemic has caused, I think it's made it even more clear that folks should have homes and houses that are healthy and safe and protect them from outside.
As you mentioned earlier, you work as the Climate and Energy Policy Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color. In advocating for legislation on this topic and the bills that we've discussed, do you encounter any misconceptions when it comes to your work or the benefits of this kind of legislation?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think what's been really exciting specifically about this bill is that it's been really collaborative. So we haven't run into that sort of misconceptions quite yet, because this bill and the campaign at large is focused on finding shared common ground and really framing things in a way that demonstrate how broad benefits from clean energy and healthy homes and energy affordability can be throughout Oregon and in coastal communities, rural communities, urban communities, poor and working class communities. So the benefits are very broad and wide reaching. And so I think that has been really important in bridging and finding shared common ground, especially between Republican and Democrat legislators, environmental groups, environmental justice advocates, such as the ones that I work with, the clean energy industry as a whole. So we have a list of all the organizations on our website who are supportive or endorsing the campaign. And you can see just from that how broad the support is. And to me, this means that opportunities in clean energy is something that so many people can get behind and understand and are coalescing around. And it means that the benefits that come with it are truly needed in communities throughout Oregon.
Right. The energy affordability bill passed the State House with bipartisan support on the 16th, isn't that right?
Yeah, it did, which is great news. And now we'll head over to the Senate.
So broadly speaking, and we've touched on this some, but what are the kinds of benefits that Oregons can expect to see in the future if these bills are passed?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, I think the reduction of emissions from energy generation is a big benefit, and this is of course will be tied to a reduction in pollution as well, but also job creation and resilience through local clean energy projects. So right now, HB 2021 is in its public comment phase, and so it had a hearing yesterday, and there are a few improvements that definitely need to be made in the first round of amendments. And I think those improvements largely center around strengthening some of the benefits that I've mentioned. So ensuring that there are strong labor standards to make sure that women and femmes and folks from marginalized communities and people of color have access to local well-paying jobs in clean energy, and that they are receiving those jobs to build our clean energy future. And then also the other benefits, like I mentioned, are local community-based clean energy projects, which we have the opportunity to really build out in HB 2021. And these are projects that are local, they might be community owned, they might generate electricity that's community owned, and it allows for more jobs locally as well as
communities to be more resilient in the face of disaster, say. The fact that these energy systems are local and community-based can make it so that they are protected from disasters that are happening in other parts of the state or nearby, and that folks can have access that's uninterrupted to electricity or essential services during these disasters. And then more broadly, I think local community-based energy projects can also help with building wealth in the communities that need it the most. And the last thing I'll say about community energy projects is that having these small-scale projects can be they have other benefits beyond economic development and resilience as well. And these can depend really on the community itself. So local energy projects, I think, have the flexibility of meeting and addressing community needs depending on what those are. And I think through HB 2021, I'm hopeful that we can build that piece out to make it really strong. And make it so that we are increasing the capacity for local clean energy projects throughout Oregon in many different communities that could really benefit from it. So to sum up, I think some of those benefits are local energy projects, resilience, good, well-paying jobs in the clean energy sector. So that's another piece that I think in the weeks moving forward, we're going to be really working together to ensure that labor standards are strong in that they're providing prevailing wages for folks who are doing this work and benefits and things like that. So I think those are some of the benefits that a clean energy future can have and some of the opportunities to see those benefits happen that HB 2021 is offering us.
So if listeners are interested in learning more about these bills, about the campaign, about your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, you can learn more by heading to cleanenergyoregon.org. This is the campaign website. You can follow the campaign on social media as well, Oregon Clean Energy on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Like I mentioned,